Well, good morning. We started a lesson last week in 2 Corinthians, and please turn your Bibles to 2 Corinthians chapter 3, where we will do the second half of last week's lesson. In 2 Corinthians chapter 3, and we will briefly talk about some of the themes that we discussed in last Sunday morning's lesson, but I want to spend most of our time and focus our attention mainly in the second half of the chapter and make some practical applications based on this. So let's begin here in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 in earnest in verses 1 through 6. 2 Corinthians 3, 1 through 6. Are we beginning to commend ourselves again? Or do we need, as some, letters of commendation to you or from you? You are our letter, he says, written in our hearts, known and read by all men, being manifested that you are a letter of Christ, cared for by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. Focus on that phrase for just a minute. Not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. We'll talk about that here. And such confidence we have, he says in verse 4, through Christ toward God, not that we are adequate in ourselves, as considering anything is coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who also made us adequate as servants of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit, for the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. And remember, one of the main reasons for writing 2 Corinthians was as a follow-up to 1 Corinthians. Paul admits that he had been hard on the Corinthians in the first letter, and he was for a reason. That was a congregation in dire straits. They had some serious social problems, spiritual problems, and moral problems, and he needed to get to the bottom of those problems before Corinth could move on as a congregation and really start thriving the way that he and God expected them to thrive. So after writing such a challenging first letter, he comes back in his second letter in a way to reestablish his credibility to the Corinthians. They had been confronted with what we typically call the Judaizing teachers, which if you weren't here last week, the Judaizing teachers were simply Christians who had come from Judaism and believed that certain superficial aspects of the Jewish religion were to be kept, even in Christianity, and forced upon Gentile converts. It was mainly things like circumcision, keeping the Sabbath day holy, and practicing food laws. So if you were a Gentile convert, a Greek or a Roman or anybody else, or anybody in this room practically, and you were not circumcised and you didn't keep the Sabbath day and you didn't follow Jewish food laws, then those Jewish converts to Christianity, the Judaizers, would either ostracize you or force you into a situation where you had to accept those components of the old law. Now the problem with that is that all of those things from the old law, as Paul and other writers attest, were old, done away with. They were being replaced by things in the new covenant. And so here in the first six verses of the chapter, the Apostle Paul is already setting up that conversation. Look at the phrases that he uses here. Tablets of stone or tablets of human hearts. What do you think the tablets of stone mean there? Well, again, like I said last week, if you saw the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, then you know what those tablets of stone are. We're talking about the Ten Commandments. We're talking about the embodiment of the old law written on those tablets of stone. And he says, that's not our letter. Our letter is not written on tablets of stone. That's not for us, that's not meant for us, and that's not who we are as God's people in the first century or the 21st century. No, our letter is written on human hearts. You are our letter, he says. If you want to know what our ministry is made of, if you want to know what kind of people we are as preachers of the gospel, if you want to know what it really means to preach salvation to people, and change people's lives, look at yourselves, Corinthians. Read that first letter sometime. Go back and read that first letter and look at the problems that the Corinthian church had. Again, socially, spiritually, morally, they were a mess. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, "You are fornicators and adulterers and drunkards and liars and homosexuals and thieves, and such were some of you. But you were washed and you were sanctified." And the inference is, you were those things, and now that you're a Christian, you're not supposed to be those things any longer. You were, and now you're not. It's not tablets of stone, it's tablets of human hearts. Look at the way the gospel changes people's lives and you'll know what its substance is supposed to be. Then he presents this idea that the Spirit is the thing that gives life and it is the letter that kills. Not, of course, the idea of the spirit of a law versus the letter of the law. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the letter being kind of this symbolic embodiment of the law itself, and the Spirit being just kind of this general term for the way that the gospel is supposed to meet us in our lives. It's a letter versus a spirit. And there's a huge difference between those two things. One gives life, one leads only to death. Now, notice in verses 7 through 11, please. "But if the ministry of death, in letters engraved on stones, came with glory, so that the sons of Israel could not look intently at the face of Moses because of the glory of his face, fading as it was, how shall the ministry of the Spirit fail to be even more with glory? For if the ministry of condemnation has glory, much more does the ministry of righteousness abound in glory. For indeed that which had glory, in this case, has no glory on account of the glory that surpasses it." And verse 11, "For if that which fades away was with glory, how much more that which remains is in glory." Now let's turn back to Exodus 34, because this is where this reference is coming from. And last week, we just didn't have time to look at this story the way I really wanted to. So we're going to go to Exodus 34 and notice some things about this particular story. And if you have not done so, put a bookmarker in 2 Corinthians 3, because we'll be going right back there here in a few minutes. But notice the whole story in its entirety in Exodus 34, beginning in verse 28. And of course, Moses has been up on the mountain receiving the law from God. He spent some considerable time up there with some frustration on the people's part, by the way. We begin here in verse 28 of Exodus 34. "So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread or drink water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments." Verse 29. "And it came about that when Moses was coming down from Mount Sinai, and the two tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hand as he was coming down from the mountain, that Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because of his speaking with God. So when Aaron and all the sons of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near to him. Then Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the rulers in the congregation returned to him, and Moses spoke to them." You notice here that Moses does not allow their fear to grip them. They're afraid at first, but he doesn't let them get away with running away, shrinking back. He forces them to come, even though they're scared. Even though they're shocked by what they see, he forces them to come back so that they can receive the law. And in verse 32, "And afterward, all the sons of Israel came near, and he commanded them to do everything that the Lord had spoken to him on Mount Sinai. When Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. But whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with them, he would take off the veil until he came out. And whenever he came out and spoke to the sons of Israel what he had been commanded, that the sons of Israel would see the face of Moses and the skin of Moses' face shone, so Moses would replace the veil over his face until he went in to speak with him," referring to God. Now, a couple things about this story, lest you misunderstand. Some translations work it a little bit differently based on a misunderstanding. The way that you're to understand the story is not that Moses would put the veil on over his face while talking to the people because they were scared of him. He would only put the veil on his face after it started to fade. He wanted the people to see his face. He wanted the people to see the glory. Not his own personal glory. That's not what it was about. He wanted the people to see the glory that was reflected in his face because of his time in the presence of God.
And when that glory began to fade, he would put the veil on his face so the people wouldn't see it fading. Now, whatever motive you might ascribe to Moses, I think is immaterial. I kind of think it's because of embarrassment. That he was God's representative, and I think he was embarrassed at the fact that as soon as he left the presence of God, his human nature simply could not hold the light that was absorbed by God. And I think he was ashamed that he would leave God's presence and immediately the glory would start to dissipate. I think it just shows that as a vessel of God, as a servant of God, he's like any of us. He was human. He was imperfect. And he simply could not carry the glory of God indefinitely. He would see God, talk to God, commune with God, receive the law, and his face would glow. And as soon as he'd walk out of the presence of God, the fade would begin. That might be a component of it. But I think another part of it for Moses was that he didn't want the people to think that this glory was supposed to be fading. I think he saw the glory fading, and he didn't want people to see God discredited by his fading face. This is God. And if I can't keep the glory in my face forever, if I can't keep it shining indefinitely, I don't want the people to see that, because my fading glory might reflect poorly on God's eternal glory. Again, whatever motive you want to assign to Moses is immaterial. The fact remains that it was a fading glory. And that's the thing we're supposed to take away from it. The glory of his face fading as it was. Now, let's acknowledge something that Paul does acknowledge to the Corinthians and to the Romans in Romans 7, verse 12. The law is good. The law is holy. The law is righteous. It did have glory. It had some glory. It was not an everlasting glory. It was not a fadeless glory, but it did have glory. While the people were afraid of the glory at first, they were nevertheless commanded to approach Moses. God and Moses wanted the people to face the glory. Not hide from it, not run from it. They needed to face the glory and acknowledge it, that what Moses said came from God. Your face just doesn't shine like that under any normal circumstances. I don't care how good of a tan you have, your face just does not shine like that in any natural sense. The law, then, was fading by design. I think that's another component that we don't always think about. Was it God's problem that Moses' face started to fade? Was that an issue with God? Was that a fault or a failure that was built into the law that God suddenly went, I didn't realize that Moses' face was going to start shining and then it would start fading as soon as he walked away? That's not God's fault, understand. And it's not necessarily a fault on Moses' part either. Moses is human. You can't keep the glory of God forever if you're merely a human. If you're a human, you're not just going to have a shiny face forever. That fade is going to begin immediately because of your nature. Because you're human. You don't have the glory of God. Fading as it is in the human face, in the flesh, by the letter of the law, there's no glory there that's going to last forever. It was intentionally weak. It was intentionally fading. It was by design. God did not want the people to think that that law was going to last forever. And I think it's just an interesting component, and kind of a practical application. He didn't want the people to think that law would last forever. He meant for that law to be temporary. He meant for that law to be replaced. He meant for the people to see that it was not something that was going to last them forever. And I think one way to think of it this way, especially as Paul puts it in verse 10, "For indeed what had glory in this case has no glory on account of the glory that surpasses it." One way that you can maybe look at that or visualize that is the glory of the sun and the moon. In the middle of the night with a full moon, does the moon have some pretty impressive glory? Of course it does. The moon is beautiful. And in the middle of the night, if the moon is the only light that you have, are you pretty appreciative of it? You know, because you go out for a lot of midnight runs, don't you? You're just like me, go out and run in the middle of the night. But you know that in the middle of the night, if the moon is your only light, you love that light. And if that's the only thing that you've got, you'll take it, right? If that's all I can get, I will take it. And you appreciate it, you love it in its place. But as soon as the sun comes up, where does the moon go? Now, you can still see the moon in the sky sometimes. Sterling and Heidi always play a game. They like to, every time we go outside, they like to look for the moon to see if they can find it. It's hard to find sometimes, though. As glorious as the moon was in the middle of the night, as soon as the sun comes up, its glory is completely and totally surpassed. You hardly even notice the moon in the sky during the daytime because of the glory of the sun that surpasses it. The law was good, and the law was holy, and humanity needed the law. Like Galatians chapter 3 explains, the law was a tutor that led us to Christ. But when Christ came, we didn't need the tutor any longer. When the sun came up, we were not guided by the moon's light anymore. Its glory faded. Its glory passed. The fading glory of Moses' face was only a foreshadow of the kind of glory repeatedly seen in the Old Testament. Israel's own history attests to this fading glory. When you read the Old Testament, what do you see? You see good times, you see bad times that turn to good times and revert back to bad times and get to good times and bad times. I tell you, when you read the Old Testament, you almost get whiplash from all the times that you're taken back and forth. It's like a pendulum swinging. Read the book of Judges sometime. The very introduction of the book of Judges in chapters 1 and 2 presents it that way. That the people did good for a little while, and then they did bad, and they got taken into captivity, and then they did good for a little while, and God brought them back, and then they did bad for a while, and then the Midianites, and then the Moabites, and then the Philistines, and it's this recurring theme that you see. The story of the kings is the same way when you read in the Samuels, the Kings and the Chronicles. You see, you have a good king, and then you have a really bad king. And then you have a pretty good king, and then a really bad king. And then you have a pretty good king. And it's back and forth and back and forth. And you know what? As great as some of those good kings are, does it ever frustrate you to read the story of Israel's history? I find it to be a very, very vexing story. Because you want them to do what's right. When you read Solomon's life, aren't you rooting for Solomon? Aren't you rooting for him? Like, come on, man. Don't make that mistake. I tell you, aren't you rooting for Rehoboam? Like, come on, Rehoboam. Do the right thing. Lower taxes. Lift the burden from the people. Listen to the wise elder statesman. Come on, Rehoboam. You're rooting for him. It's a frustrating story to read. As glorious as their kings were, as glorious as their temple was their temple torn down? All it took was Nebuchadnezzar's army, and they tore that temple down. And when they rebuilt that temple in the time of Ezra, the older citizens of the city who remembered the first temple were crying. Some people think they were crying for joy. I think that's part of it. But I think part of it also is that they were crying because they realized that the temple they were building was never going to be as big or as nice as Solomon's temple. They could never replace it. I think there was a little bit of disappointment there. There was glory in Israel, but it was never lasting glory. And if all you were fixated on was Jerusalem and David and a temple and a throne, wouldn't you be frustrated by that story too? If that's all the glory that you ever saw, wouldn't you be frustrated by that story too? So we are exposed to greater glory. Why does the Spirit come with greater glory than the old law? That's an interesting question to think about. I mean, if you had two things laid out, two options laid out before you, and you could pick the old law with its glory, and you had a temple, and you had a physical people, and a physical nation, and a king sitting on a throne, or if you could pick the glory of the gospel in Jesus Christ, if you had those two things laid out, why does Jesus come with greater glory? Why not focus entirely on the law and the flesh? Fundamentally, there's a difference between those two things. One is the way of futility, inadequacy, and death. The other, fruitfulness, boldness, and life. We use this phrase, only skin deep. Isn't it funny that the glory of Moses' face was literally only skin deep? The glory of the old law was literally skin deep. That's as far as it went. But the glory of Christ is spiritual. It is not fleshly. It is spiritual. It is beyond any measure of fleshly glory. Which is why if you were focused on the fleshly glory, you'd have to be pretty ashamed of yourself. We don't rule the world, do we? We don't have a president from our own midst who runs the country. There are not very many millionaires among our midst. I mean, if you looked at it just in pure fleshly terms, there's not a whole lot that the gospel offers. But remember what Peter and Isaiah both said about the flesh. As Peter quotes Isaiah from Isaiah chapter 40, read what he says here in 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 22. 1 Peter 1 and verse 22. Since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart, for you've been born again. Look at this. I love this. You have been born again, not of seed which is perishable, but seed which is imperishable. That is, through the living and abiding word of God. Look what he says about the glory of flesh, the glory of the flowers, the glory of the earth. Look what it says here about that glory. All flesh is like grass, and all its glory like the flower of the grass. The grass withers. The flower falls off. But the word of the Lord abides forever, and this is the word which was preached to you. The word which was preached to you is an abiding word. It is an abiding glory. Now, I want to bring things home here. I want to be pretty practical about the way that we approach this last section here. Read verses 12 through 15 of our text. Having therefore such a hope, we use great boldness in our speech, and not as Moses, who used to put a veil over his face, that the sons of Israel might not look intently at the end of what was fading away. And again, that's that emphasis there, is Moses didn't want them to see the glory fading. He didn't want them to see the end of it. He didn't want them to see the whole process of glorious face of Moses fading, 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 back to, oh, ho-hum, normal face of Moses. He didn't want them to see the end of it. Verse 14, but their minds were hardened, for until this very day at the reading of the Old Covenant, the same veil remains unlifted, because it is removed only in Christ. To this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their heart. What is the veil of false glory? Now for them, I think you could say it was the temple. And they had a pretty nice temple in the first century, by the way. Herod did a nice job. I honestly think, and this is just my personal assessment of the historical Herod the Great, that it was Herod's goal to build bigger. That was always his goal. Everything he built had to be bigger. Everything he built had to look good. It had to be the right thing. It had to impress outsiders and insiders alike. And the temple that he built was a really nice temple. So it might be easy for them to go to the city of Jerusalem and look at their glorious temple that had been built by their Idumean king and to get fixated on that. It might be very easy for them to look at the implements within that temple, things made of gold. It might be very easy for them to look at the sacrifices. After all, someone like Solomon sacrificed thousands and thousands of sheep at a time. It was pretty ridiculous, in fact, the number of sheep and goats and bulls that Solomon would regularly sacrifice. It's like my dad always said, though, is it quality or is it quantity? They could easily look at the glory of the temple and fixate on that. And they'd have a veil over their face. They might look at self-derived righteousness, like the Pharisees. You see, as long as I tithe my mint, my dill, and my cumin, as long as I can micromanage every little tiny part of my life, as long as I can focus on the little things, the little tiny details, and I can keep the traditions of the elders that even go beyond what the law required of us, then maybe I can be so righteous that I can earn my way, force my way, thrust myself upon God. That's the veil of false glory. You can pat yourself on the back all day long, but that's not the glory of the gospel. But you know, it's not just first century people who had a problem with this. You could look at the cathedrals. You could look at the beautiful worship centers. You could look at the 10,000 seat facilities. And they're pretty nice. In fact, in researching this lesson, I'll be honest with you, I actually went to St. Mary's Basilica in downtown Phoenix. Not to poke fun or anything like that, because that's never my intention. I don't go somewhere to poke fun. I don't use that as an example to say, oh, people are so stupid, they don't get it. That's not my intention. I wanted to be surrounded by the glory that people of the world tend to think of when it comes to religious glory. And so I sat there in St. Mary's Basilica, which is, it's open to the public. I sat there and looked at the stained glass windows, and I saw the statues and the beautiful paintings. Sterling was very impressed also. He was awestruck by the whole thing. And he was surprisingly quiet also. I told him, now we have to be quiet when we go in here. And he was like, okay. But you know, if that's what you're fixated on, if God's glory is to be found in architecture, and if God's glory is to be found in stained glass windows, and if God's glory is to be found in really, really tall hats, I mean, I'm sorry, you've got a veil over your face. But, you know, maybe God's glory is found in being a number one New York Times bestseller list. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's where you find your glory. You know, Joel Osteen, he preaches where the Houston Rockets used to play. That is a 20,000-seat stadium. That's a 20,000-seat stadium where he preaches. It's a pretty nice facility. And Joel Osteen, I'll just put it this way, he's got some hair on his head, too. But if that's all the glory that you see, I'm sorry, you have a veil over your face. But maybe we should bring it home even a little closer. Maybe you think that if you stand before Christians every Sunday, and you wear a suit and a tie, you act really righteous, and you got the perfect white, middle-class, suburban family, maybe you think you punch your card, you do your peg, you do your Bible class work, maybe you feel like you're a pretty glorious Christian. I'm sorry, you've got a veil over your face. You could be perfect Charlie Church, and you've got a veil over your face. Because that's not what it's about. That's all part of it, of course. You want to do your Bible class lesson. You want to be here. You want to attend. That's something that we ought to do. That's something that we must do. But if that's what you think the glory is, you got a veil over your face. Take the veil off and see where the real glory is. Notice verse 16. Whenever a man turns to the Lord, the veil's taken away. These are opposite vectors, if you will. Fixation on the glory of the letter takes you one direction. And it takes you further and further and further away from God. So that you might wake up one day and you are just not even in His presence one tiny bit. Now, that could be the glory of the temple in Jerusalem. That could be the glory of a cathedral. It could be the glory of money and fame. Or it could be just the glory of sitting right here at Monte Vista and thinking you are all that. Wherever the glory comes, whatever you think it is, that glory takes you in the direction away from God. Let me give you another vector. When you start recognizing the glory of the Spirit, that brings you closer to God. And here's the issue. It's almost like a paradox, isn't it? It's almost like a paradox. The more glory you see in the architecture and the buildings and the money and the numbers, the more glory you see there, the less you're able to see the glory of God. Now, you're not a sinner if you go to a really big congregation. You're not a sinner if your congregation happens to have a very nice building in a very nice part of town. That doesn't make you a sinner and that doesn't make you a bad Christian. But do you think that's where the glory is? Do you think that makes you glorious? Does that make your face shine in the eyes of the people around you? Does it make your face shine as you stand before God? That doesn't make you a sinner to have money or to be rich. But the more you fixate on it, the more you look at the flesh instead of the Spirit, you are going in the opposite direction of God. You're going in the opposite direction of God. But the more you start fixating on the Spirit and seeing the spiritual side of things and appraising things from a spiritual point of view,
the closer you get to God. Now, you might find yourself going very, very far away from physical glory. But you might find yourself understanding spiritual glory even deeper. You know, Rogelio doesn't need to have a nice church building. And Rogelio doesn't need to live in a really, really nice country with a very high standard of living. And Rogelio doesn't have to preach in front of 500 people every Sunday. He'd probably be mad at me if I was talking about him so much also, because I know he's a modest person. I stole this from his Facebook page, by the way. That's Rogelio baptizing somebody in a muddy pool on the side of the road. And that is more glorious than any cathedral or temple that man could build. Take the veil off. Take the veil off and see God's glory. Sometimes God's glory really, really doesn't look like glory. But it really, really is glory. Jesus didn't look like glory. But he was the most glorious thing that ever came to this planet. Jesus was a dirt poor carpenter's son. He came from Galilee. He was a nobody from nowhere leading a bunch of nobodies. And he died a criminal's death on a cross. Spat upon, insulted, rejected, outside the city. And he is the most glorious thing that has ever happened to planet Earth and to humanity at large. The Apostle Paul said something in his first epistle to the Corinthians that really sticks with me. From 1 Corinthians chapter 2, notice what he had to say here about appraising things from a fleshly versus a spiritual perspective. In 1 Corinthians 2, begin in verse 6. And I know it's a lengthy passage of Scripture. We'll go ahead and end here on this passage. Yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. A wisdom, however, not of this age, nor the rulers of this age who are passing away. It's kind of the same language as in 2 Corinthians 3, isn't it? But we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory. There's your word for the day. The wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood. For if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But just as it is written, things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard, which have not entered into the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love Him. Verse 10 says, for to us God revealed them through the Spirit, and the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of man except the Spirit of man which is in him? Even so the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Now we have received, he says, not the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. But he says that the natural man, in verse 14, the natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they're foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. Now, what he means by naturalist, he means physical. People who are focused on the physical, the earthly, the fleshly. But he who is spiritual, he says, appraises all things, yet he himself is appraised by no man. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him? But he says, we have the mind of Christ. Which is, I think, why he concludes this passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 so beautifully in verse 17. Now the Lord is the Spirit. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's liberty. But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as from the Lord, the Spirit. It is a unified message from 1 Corinthians to 2 Corinthians. It's a unified message that the gospel presents to us. My friend, it is time for you to take the veil off. My friend, it is time for you to put that veil away. It's time to stop thinking about the things of this world, the flesh and its glory. Open your eyes and see that there is more glory to be found in one humble soul turning to the Lord than in 1,000 people being led away by the millionaires, the billionaires, the celebrities, the fakes of the world. Take your veil off.
become a Christian, and enter into what is truly the most glorious pursuit in all of history. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.